Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of our show, we'll be talking about human rights issues as they apply to indigenous people around the world. It's estimated that there are something like 370 million indigenous people who live in some 70 countries around the world. And compared with the general populations of their countries, they often have higher rates of infant mortality, they have less access to education, and often they have limited participation in the government of their countries. In this hour of our show, we'll talk a bit about the efforts to secure the rights of historically marginalized groups, and our guest for the program is Dr. Julian Berger. He is coordinator of the Indigenous and Minorities Unit at the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, based in Geneva. He joined the UN in 1990 and since 1991 has been responsible for Indigenous issues at the office. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana and gave a talk on the campus. This was actually yesterday. This is the 17th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture, which is named for Daniel Sanders, who was the dean of the School of Social Work from 1986 until 1989. We have had a number of the speakers here who have been on the campus to give this lecture here on our show over the years, and we're pleased that Dr. Berger could be with us as well. Questions are welcome as we talk, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. As I say, anyone's welcome to call and join the conversation. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief in their comments just so that we can keep the program moving along. But, of course, anyone who is listening should feel welcome to join us. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Just to ask a kind of a general question, your talk was put in the context of the fact that it's been 60 years since the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948. So that's a good round figure, a good benchmark kind of thing, and an opportunity to say, well, if we look around the world and we ask how are we doing in guaranteeing human rights for everyone now 60 years on, how are we doing?
Well, you know, I guess at 60 years, most people are thinking of a nice, comfortable retirement and taking it easy and having accomplished something. And I think with human rights, you never fully accomplish fulfillment. But if we take a kind of, let's say, a little view of what was going on 60 years back and we take a view today, I think that there is much greater agreement internationally on what is right and what is wrong. That is to say, what are the rights that should be established in countries in all areas, child rights, women's rights, individual rights, and now increasingly rights of groups such as minorities and indigenous people. So I think we've made tremendous progress in getting 180 states or so to agree on the basics. Because the real issue is getting the implementation at the country level. This has always been a challenge. I don't think we can say we have a happy ending, but I think many of us feel that we've made progress, we've raised issues, we've given visibility to new areas. Just recently, a convention on disabled persons, which is very important to have international agreement on the rights disabled people should have, for example. Mm-hmm. And this took a lot of, you know, discussions and so forth. So, yes, I think we've made progress in getting agreement on what should be established at the national level. Getting it implemented, we still have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose if you start to engage people in a conversation about human rights and you simply ask them, well, what do you think we mean by that? What constitutes human rights? You might begin with statements that are at one time both sweeping and yet simple. But then I think as you talk about it, you realize that it starts to get more complicated, so that coming up with some kind of definition that is comprehensive and that you can get everybody to agree to is not an easy thing.
It's not an easy thing. I mean, you know, I remember the discussions around child rights. What is a child? When do you become a child? When do you become an adult? This has always been an interesting discussion and one very important. You know, should we apply rights to those under 18? Do we consider them children or We have another cutoff age. Each culture has a different perception of childhood. And the whole discussion around that issue can be quite complex. Issues of women's rights are, of course, very difficult. Culturally, there are different attitudes to all women, even though rights are established internationally. So bringing everybody around a table, getting them to discuss, getting understanding on all sides, I mean, that's a little bit what the UN is about. It's getting people who have quite different and sometimes conflicting views to sit and listen to each other and to try to find a consensus. Sometimes, I mean, the consensus looks very disappointing. It may not be the standards we would like, but that is rather what the UN has to do. It has to bring people together. It has to help people find solutions that they can all mutually agree upon, and that's its role, really.
Well, what is it? Forgive me, this is an awfully general question, but if you ask the question, what are the major obstacles to guaranteeing human rights for people all around the world? Are there particular things that stand out?
Well, I think one issue which is quite significant is that many people around the world, the vast majority of people, don't know that they have rights. I mean, in a way, they think that the government kindly may help them or may not help them, but rights are about obligations of states, and states take on that obligation by signing or ratifying international treaties. So if a state has said, we are firmly against racial discrimination, we agree to abide by the International Convention on Elimination of Racial Discrimination, they agree to put into the legislation and implement a series of actions in order to eliminate or move towards the elimination of racial discrimination. So there's an obligation upon the state. And I think many people around the world do not realize that these rights are something which governments have committed to and they have obligations to fulfill. And I think that's a very important message to get across. And so many people around the world actually don't know that they have rights. And I think that's a big step forward if we can get people to know that. That's one obstacle. I think the other is, of course, the difficulties in real life, it's very nice to say, well, we should have this and we should have that and this should be respected, and of course, but we're in a real world. Sometimes this is difficult. Implementation is always a challenge because ultimately implementation goes on at the community level, at the local level, and it depends on people. It depends on people respecting others and respecting laws and abiding by the laws. And of course, that's not always kind of working out quite like that. But I think the great challenge is really, for me, making people aware of their rights and then encouraging them to seek their fulfillment and respect by the governments concerned.
Mm-hmm. It seems that one of the great challenges that a body like the United Nations has is that it's one thing to get people to sign on to an agreement and to get them to say, we believe in these things and they're very important and we'll work toward them. It's another thing entirely to actually get them to do it, and the United Nations really doesn't have any, even after, if you can get a government to sign on to something like this, really the United Nations doesn't have, or does the United Nations have ways to put pressure on the government to fulfill the commitment that it makes?
Well, I think it does have some not very sharp teeth. I mean, it does have pressure. I mean, it has what we would call peer pressure. It has other states that publicly condemn, which is not always comfortable for states and can lead to changes because states don't like to be in the spotlight and so on. We have mechanisms, expert committees, which review states' implementation of human rights and provide advice. And the UN system also provides technical support for those states. For example, let's take access to education, primary education. A state has an obligation to educate its citizens, its children. There may be technical reasons that mean that they can't deliver. And in such cases, we might be possible through the UN system, through the UNICEF, which is a child's rights part of the UN, or the UNESCO, which deals with education, to assist governments technically to make those facilities available. So there is that. But in some ways, the advantage of the UN is that it doesn't have teeth, actually. It's only about people talking and trying to convince each other. It's about the moral of human rights. And I think there might be something rather frightening about a UN that could pull in, Marines every time there was a problem that was wrong. Because in fact, sometimes what seems like a problem at some point can be resolved over time through discussion. And the UN is about discussion. It's about people finding agreement together and saying this is the right way to go. It's not about enforcing an agreement. It's about people trying to find a solution together. So I think in some sense, its strength is that it is not able to enforce in that way which, let's say, a state can enforce its view through military means or others.
Mm-hmm. Well, and certainly the United Nations has the ability to shine the light on a particular place, and as well as there are other non-governmental organizations whose particular brief is human rights, who can do the same thing and periodically issue reports about the state of human rights around the world. And certainly they would single out particular places that they say are problematic. And I suppose that we assume that there are governments that just don't care if they're labeled as leading violators of human rights. And I suppose I wonder to what extent that is true and whether, in fact, governments are interested in their image around the world and whether being labeled as a violator of human rights is something that actually might lead governments to do something about that.
Well, I think increasingly with visibility of human rights and the importance it's given by us as citizens, by the media, it helps to encourage a kind of more affirmative action to ensure that they're mm-hmm. applied. If states are violators of human rights, we as citizens take action ourselves, I mean, in different ways. We can see it a little bit with the positions that citizens have taken on China, for example, over the Olympic Games and so on, have said, well, this is an issue. We feel compelled to say something, to use this opportunity to raise issues about this particular country. So I think a lot is dependent on the will of individuals and the will of society to be able to take forward issues and to put their pressure on those who are engaged with those states. And as you know, most official visits by politicians, by heads of government to countries where there are violations of human rights, the pressure is upon the prime minister or the president to raise those issues internationally, to link aid and so on to human rights. So there are many linkages to make. And so there are pressures. And I think many states, I think there are few states who can ignore human rights today. I think states do have to take them into consideration in their international arena. They cannot live in total isolation and just go about their business and ignore the public opinion, international opinion.
Just very quickly, again, our guest this morning is Dr. Julian Berger. He is a coordinator of the Indigenous and Minorities Unit at the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights based in Geneva. He's here visiting the campus, gave a talk on the subject of human rights and Indigenous people. That was last night, and we're pleased to have him here with us so we can bring him to a little bit larger audience, past those who could actually hear him in person. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I expect that often when people hear discussions of human rights or think about that, one of the first things that they think about has to do with political participation and open government and the ability to challenge their own governments, which certainly is an issue. That's a facet here. But also, I think it goes much more broad. It's more broad than that. When we're talking about people's ability to live their lives freely, to have security in their persons and their homes, to be able to take care of their families, to have access to education, to health care, as well as being able to participate in politics. And so here we're really talking about some of the issues that are faced by the marginalized people in any given society. And it's sadly enough, it seems, when you look around the world, some of the most marginalized people in many societies are the indigenous people. And they are indeed the ones that do have the serious issues with simply managing to make a living, take care of their families, have access to education, have access to health care, have some sort of voice in their country's governance. So here, all of these issues certainly apply very dramatically to indigenous people.
Yeah, well, of course, you're quite right. And statistics, data that you get from governments indicate that of all of the groups in society, indigenous peoples are generally those that are the most marginalized. If you take things like unemployment, poverty levels, income levels, access to education, health statistics, and so on and so forth, you can pluck out figures from all around the world showing that indigenous peoples are really treated and discriminated against in the society in which they live, and certainly do not get the benefits that others get. Even in very rich countries, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, US, you find that indigenous peoples have much less life expectancy than the rest. Australian Aborigine, on the whole, 20 years less than the average Australian, and so on. So, yes, the answer is these groups are really facing many difficulties in the area of economic and social rights. Of course, why is that the problem? Why is that a problem? There's a whole legacy behind that. There's a whole legacy of marginalization by states, and perhaps not enough focus by states to sit with indigenous peoples and try and figure out together with them what the solutions are. Very often states have come in and imposed their own solutions, which have not been successful, and have rarely sat down with indigenous people to say, let's work out something together. How do you see the future? How do you want to organize things so that you bring health and you bring economic benefits and you bring education into your community in the most appropriate, culturally appropriate way?
It was not until, I believe, last fall that the UN General Assembly adopted the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And this is something that apparently had been in the works for back since started in the early 1980s.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
So this was a long way. And I'm sure that, you know, as organizations like the UN, you know, the wheels grind slow but exceeding fine. So it can take a long time before you get things like this worked out. Language is very important, and getting things so that you can get everybody to agree is a very difficult business. And when you have as many nations as there are, you know, this can take a long time. And apparently there were a number of nations that said we're not going to sign on to this. But, you know, having said that, are you at all disappointed that it took so long, that it took until 2007 for such a thing to come to pass?
Well, there's a yes and a no to that, to that question. The yes is, of course, yes, we like to move faster if we could. It's very frustrating to see that we need to develop agreement on rights for a particular group of people and to have an enormous time frame in order to do it, just not get it done, and for the years to pass and nothing to get achieved. But there is another side, and the positive side, I think, of taking what this has taken now 20 years or so. I think we began in 1985, so in fact 22 years, if you take it strictly speaking, from the moment we first put pen to paper, began to write some of the provisions down, and September 2007, when finally the General Assembly adopted this document. So, yes, it's been a long haul, but one of the advantages of having a long time is people spend time listening to each other and learning about each other. And I think that has been very, very important in this particular document, actually in most documents, because in developing new human rights standards where people do not agree, what you have to do is build up understanding about the issues. For example, indigenous people's rights to their lands. Now, first of all, governments might say, well, yeah, they have an EI. If they've got a piece of title to the land, you know, that's their land, no problems. But if indigenous peoples have traditionally always lived on their lands and have different ways of recording their rights to land, which may be through oral traditions, through legends, through some form of treaties, through songs, as is the case in Aboriginal communities in Australia and so on, how do you accommodate an understanding of indigenous peoples' own understandings of their land? So that's just one issue of many about which you can't solve immediately, because you have to try to understand better the communities, understand better the diversities, understand the issues. So actually it's been advantageous in some ways to allow this period of germination, to allow people to understand better the issues, not just of governments, but also of civil servants, of those who will have to implement at a later stage, to understand what are the issues, you know. So I think that's been important. And then just one other comment. The truth is that we say it takes a long time, but of course, and when you put it on paper and you say, well, it took 22 years, but we were meeting for sometimes once a year for 5 days. So you have to put it in. That's just the way the UN functions. Of course, it meant we weren't working 51 weeks of the year on this. We brought people together because of expense and other reasons, you know, on an annual basis to try to bring people together, and they met and they moved it, the issue forward, and then they came back again and so on and so forth. So in this kind of agreement, there is a time frame, but I actually believe the time frame has been useful because it's helped raise a better understanding of indigenous people's issues amongst states. And that allowed in 2007 something which would have been impossible 20 years ago. The government sign on to a document that recognizes indigenous people's self-determination, their rights to land and their rights to their resources, their rights to maintain their own forms of government, and so on and so forth. So these things, I think, were unthinkable when governments were facing that, you know, 15, 20 years back, but they were able to accept it because they understood the importance of it for indigenous people. But that takes dialogue, that takes elders coming and telling their stories. It takes young people telling their aspirations. It takes women talking about their issues and so on and so forth. And with the accumulation of all that kind of understanding, the stories that are told, then governments understand better and a decision is taken on that basis.
Yeah, I get when you put it that way, I suppose one has to appreciate the difficulties of doing this. And I'm certain that over that period of time, the people that were representing those countries changed and that... it occupied a lot of different people, and perhaps every time somebody new came along, they had to, in a sense, be brought into the process. And governments changed, and as I said, the representatives changed. So, when you look at it from that perspective, perhaps it's a wonder that it only took 20 years.
Yeah, I think you're right. Of course, actually, indigenous delegates stayed more or less the same. There are some, you know, veterans of this declaration. But as you say, on the whole, diplomats move every 3 to 4 years usually and so on. But, I mean, governments do accumulate positions. So, you know, let's say position papers are prepared within the governments and things move along. So there is a kind of retention of institutional knowledge, even though the individual may change, the governments or the departments responsible will learn and will develop positions, and those positions will modify over time. So I think that, yes, the individuals do move, but that also makes it often very difficult and very frustrating for indigenous peoples who actually have to each year repeat the stories in order for the diplomats to understand better the situation. So I think more for them it was a little bit of a source of frustration.
There were some countries, some of them with significant indigenous populations, that actually voted against the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. One of them was the United States, also Australia and Canada and New Zealand. How does one explain that?
Well, of course, I'm not there to explain how the U.S. and Australia and New Zealand vote. They did vote. They were the four countries in the General Assembly that voted against. Since then, of course, there's been some changes. Australian government has changed, and the position of the government towards the declaration is far more positive. And as you may or may not know, the Canadian Parliament just recently came out with a resolution in favor of the declaration, even though the government itself is not in favor of supporting the declaration. Mm-hmm. There were a number of issues raised by these governments. Some were uncomfortable with the provisions dealing with land and resource issues and felt that these were not clear enough for them to make sure that there were no, let's say, confusions about whose rights were supreme on land and resource issues. I think there was still concern about what the term self-determination meant and that this should not be deemed to be something which would lead to any threats to the territorial integrity of states and so on and so forth. I think probably the main issues were around resources, frankly. I think, as you probably know, these are four countries with indigenous peoples living on lands that are fairly resource-rich. There are quite strong movements amongst indigenous peoples in those countries to ensure that they get some benefits from those resources that are on their lands, sometimes leading to court cases and so on and so forth. So I suppose that there was some thinking that, you know, we shouldn't, I guess this was an issue of resources where we should be a little bit careful and we're not so comfortable about doing this at the international level and kind of putting into some standards at the international level that indigenous peoples have rights also over the natural resources on their lands.
Hmm. Well, if, say, supposing that the attitudes of the governments of Australia and Canada change, perhaps, as long as the government of the United States is not signed on, that would seem to be a significant obstacle to the declaration being fully implemented. Or would you say that if most of the rest of the world says this is important to us and we're going to make a commitment, then does it matter whether or not the United States is on board?
Well, maybe just a clarification. When the United Nations adopts a declaration, this is not legally binding on a state. It's an aspirational document. And the way the UN feels is that it's created a framework of provisions, a framework which helps governments to negotiate and discuss with their indigenous peoples. It creates that framework, but it allows the flexibility for the governments and indigenous peoples to kind of work through it and find out the solution that's appropriate to them, given the particular conditions. Countries are quite different. Guatemala, for example, has 60% of the population are Mayan Indians. Australia, it's less than 1%. You can't really think of the solutions being exactly the same in each country and so on, for all sorts of reasons. So solutions are different. But in the General Assembly adopting this document, what has been adopted is a universal standard for all countries, without exception, and because it is non-binding. And it is expected that states would comply to the degree that they can with the provisions of the declaration. As I say, it's not legally binding, but it sets a framework. Having said that, of course, governments change, and I guess you will probably you may have some change in governments here in the U.S., and we hope that any new government would also reconsider the declaration and look at it and say, well, this is actually pretty close to what we have here in U.S., because it frankly is very close to what you have in U.S. And in fact, in some parts of U.S. Law, the situation of indigenous peoples is actually stronger than we have in the declaration. So it would seem to me a little bit of a pity that any new government wouldn't want to look at it and say, well, let's look at it a little bit more closely and see if we can go along with this and express our support for this as a useful document to help us to work towards bringing justice to these indigenous peoples around the world.
Well, to what extent other places then is conflict over control of resources a central issue? Do you find that as I see in there were some nations that abstained, including Nigeria, for example, where I'm sure that there are significant issues surrounding natural resource use and exploitation, and Russia was also included. I'm not quite sure about some of the others, but is that a big issue in many places around the world?
Well, I think probably it's one of the big issues. I mean, basically, indigenous peoples' lands have always been coveted. I mean, that's the whole history of our colonial past, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And to some extent, indigenous people still live on lands, and still these lands have resources, and increasingly we're wanting to have access to them and exploit these resources. So yes, I think this is probably all around the world one of the issues that is important, but it's not the only issue. But it is critical, and I don't think that necessarily the abstention of Nigeria and the Russian Federation were necessarily simply about that. There may be other issues involved, but and as you know, abstaining from something doesn't mean that you're against it either. I mean, abstaining means maybe something a little bit different. I mean, it's a little bit of a milder kind of form of support. But I think the issues of resources and indigenous people are interesting because there are solutions out there and they have been found. Indigenous peoples are increasingly sitting down with private sector, sitting down with governments to look for solutions, to find ways in which they can be sharing of benefits, in which sacred sites and environmental protection is ensured, that there are vocational training for their own people so that they can bring them into the employment and so on and so forth. So there are some interesting solutions out there as well. Indigenous peoples are not saying, we don't want resources exploited or used. What we thought they're saying is that so often these resources have been exploited by others. We haven't got any benefits. They've been highly destructive to us in our societies and into our environment, and so on. What we're looking at is that we should determine whether or not a project goes forward. It should be for us to decide, because these are our lands, and what will be left behind when that project is finished will still be our lands. So we want to make sure that they remain in the same kind of pristine quality that we can assure for our future generations and so on. So there are all these factors involved.
Yeah. We are a bit past our midpoint. Our guest is Dr. Julian Berger. He's coordinator of the Indigenous and Minorities Unit at the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. It's based in Geneva. He joined the UN in 1990 and since 91 has been responsible for Indigenous issues at the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. He's worked in several countries, including Australia, Chile, Brazil, Guatemala, India, and Thailand. He's also traveled widely in the course of his human rights career in Africa and the Arctic, Pacific, Asia, and Latin America. He's visiting the campus to give a talk last night. This was the 17th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture. It's named in honor of Dan Sanders, who was dean of the School of Social Work from 1986 until 1989. We're talking about human rights, particularly human rights of indigenous people around the world. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think that it is the case that for a lot of indigenous people, a big issue that they have had to deal with was efforts by governments of the countries where they live, sometimes perhaps with good intentions, often not, to compel them to assimilate. And I wonder, you know, to what extent when you talk about human rights, that what you're talking about is the right of people to continue to live as they have lived, to speak their language, to practice their religion, to live their culture, to make their living the way that they have, and to live at, in the place that they have. And in part, it's people saying what they want is to be left alone, or at least to live in the way that they always have.
Yeah, I think that you're quite right. I think that one of the, let's say, predominant policies of governments until comparatively recently, if we're talking of the 50s and 60s, was that indigenous peoples were somehow left behind, and therefore we needed to help them to come up to our standards, if we can use it like that, and therefore the policy was basically assimilation. And in fact, until 1957, the International Labour Organization adopted a convention. It was the first effort by the international system to identify the rights of indigenous peoples. And in that convention, basically it stated quite clearly, and that was reflecting the international trend or policy of the time, the policy was to assimilate indigenous peoples into the mainstream society, and that was the purpose of that convention. Things have dramatically changed since then, and indigenous peoples have said, we do not want to be assimilated into a society. We strongly object to quite a lot of what we see going on around us. We want to maintain our language, our culture, our value system. We want to live on our lands. We have different concepts of development to you. We have different ways of perceiving education to you. We have ways of living which are collective, and we don't so much like the ways you have an individual kind of individualistic way of living, and so on and so forth. And so the United Nations has responded for that, but to try and identify how it can protect those rights. And as you quite rightly say, I think indigenous peoples are now saying, we want to determine our futures. This is why they say we want a right of self-determination. It's not we want a right to create a new state. We want a right to determine how we will bring up our children, how we will organize our resources, how we will organize amongst ourselves, how we will take decisions together, and so on and so forth. And these may not be the same way as our society. And increasingly, indigenous peoples are putting it into practice. And I think that it's perfectly compatible with the state. And it's, you know, you have already in US many indigenous peoples who have their own governments, their own justice systems, that have their run their own economic, their own economies, and so on. So that it's perfectly possible, and it can function. But many states find that very difficult. And our job, I think, is to persuade states that this is not threatening to them as national entities,
that actually enhances the diversity within the state. And of course, it actually is a human rights issue, I think, for us, that indigenous peoples, like all of us, would determine how we live and how we organize our lives.
Mm. Well, that I suppose that leads me to wonder just to what extent there are places where the fact that there are distinct cultural, ethnic minority groups within larger states that are requesting, in some cases demanding, if not independence, and in many cases that's really not a particular option, but certainly they are demanding greater autonomy. Yeah. And that I could imagine that in a lot of places we know that in a lot of places that has been a source of conflict. To what extent does that kind of situation make this whole business a much more complicated?
Well, I think it is difficult. As I said to you earlier, the declaration that the UN adopted is a framework, so it allows a lot of choices. It's a kind of multiple choice kind of document. It allows a lot of areas in which people could be self-determining, which don't necessarily mean autonomy. But autonomy and self-government can be conflictual and cannot be conflictual. And some indigenous peoples are not looking for autonomy or self-government, but simply full participation. If we take most Latin American countries where indigenous peoples are an important part of the population, Bolivia, Ecuador, Peru, Guatemala, and so on and so forth, you'll find that, in fact, they're not looking for any kind of autonomous arrangements. What they're looking for is fuller participation in decision-making, having been excluded historically from any kind of positions of political power. So this is, or economic, access to any economic resources and so on. So this is something which in certain countries is much more in line with, as we understand, self-determination, which is the full participation of all of us in the political life of the state. Of course, in some countries, indigenous peoples are looking for some autonomy on their traditional lands. That can mean ensuring that their lands are not taken over by others, that people do not come onto their lands uninvited, that they have resources to maintain some services on their lands, that they have the use of the natural resources on those lands, and so on and so forth. So it can be expressed in forms of autonomy. And in other countries, it might be expressed in services that are run by indigenous peoples. So, for example, Australia, indigenous peoples have talked very much about the importance of their indigenous peoples themselves running the health services that are on the community, because they say the health system, the national health system, is not culturally appropriate to them. They need something which is familiar to the indigenous peoples and to their culture. Indigenous peoples have argued for controls over schools, because they feel that if they have their own schools and they run their own schools, they'll be in a position to ensure the transmission of the language, to ensure that the values that they think are important are transmitted to their children, that other, let's say, curricula are developed which are more relevant to them in terms of history, in terms of the way the society lives, and so on and so forth. So the idea of autonomy, it's just one of a number of options which you have in this sort of range of possibilities in self-determination. And I think it's important that according to where you live and how indigenous peoples relate to the state, to explore how that can be put into practice. And I think that's a helpful vision, but self-determination is not just about creating little spaces and cutting yourself off from the rest. Self-determination is that how can you fully participate? How can we also be free? How can we also develop the things that we think are important, that maintain our identity? Sometimes it's in the form of creating these physical spaces that you have in Canada or you have in US and some, or it might be just having certain parts of the services, you know, that are appropriate in the community itself. I don't know, you know, if that makes sense to you, but...
Yeah. Well, how then one might wonder, just in the integration of indigenous people into conventional structures of government, that is, having people in the having indigenous people in the parliament or the National Assembly, or having indigenous people actually with posts in government, how successful or who has really been successful at doing that?
Well, I think that increasingly indigenous peoples have won political positions. Well, we can see Bolivia just 2 years ago, for the very first time in the history of Bolivia, has elected an indigenous president. We see in Latin America increasingly indigenous peoples in senior positions in government, ministerial posts, and so on. This is relatively new. This is not something that if you went back 20, 25 years, you would find. This is very important. And I think very important also is that indigenous peoples are increasingly playing a role in municipal and local affairs, which, again, they were very much excluded from, where they're often the majority population, but have, on the whole, been denied access to those political positions, such as the mayor or the councillors and so on, at municipal level, where you can have enormous influence on bringing benefits to the community. So I think there has been a trend towards the inclusion of indigenous peoples in politics. I think it's beneficial, and I think that it's being felt, and it's shifted the national policy, because as indigenous people have positions within either national governments, local or regional or municipal level governments, they're able to influence the national agenda and priorities in terms of budgeting.
Mm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Dr. Julian Berger. He's coordinator of the Indigenous and Minorities Unit at the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, and he's particularly responsible in his work for Indigenous issues there. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I wondered, you know, to what extent it is the case that indigenous people are going to become increasingly assimilated, and that it will be difficult for them to maintain the ways that they have lived, and that's may well be a simple fact of life that has to do with their, maybe more than anything else, their becoming integrated into the economy of their countries, and that they will have to make compromises about how they live and what they do and what language they speak, a variety of things that simply have to do with the kind of compromises you have to do with making a living, and that there's something going on here that's a trend that's very difficult to turn aside.
Well, I think I think you're right in one side, because we know from looking at developments over the last years, there's been migration out of indigenous people's lands to other countries to seek employment because it's no longer possible to survive on the lands, or because they've been displaced from their lands, and indigenous peoples have also moved to cities. In many parts of the world, probably about 50% of indigenous peoples now live in urban areas. In some countries, it goes up to 80 or 85%. And, of course, there is a tremendous concern about loss of language in particular. And I know that my colleagues in UNESCO who've carried out studies on that estimate that around 90% of languages are at risk over the next century. So we're really talking about possible loss of languages, and the language, of course, is a source of knowledge and so on. But there is something, there's a sort of another side to it, and that is how indigenous peoples may assimilate us a little bit. And I say that quite deliberately, because if you think of the way we think about the natural world and the environment and how we have changed in the last 10, 15, 20 years. And we've changed our attitudes from one where the natural world, resources, forests and so on, were places which we could just, in a way, use. They were there for us to exploit. That was man's right, in a way, and his skill and his to take these lands and to exploit them for our benefits and to master them to a certain extent. The way we think about that natural world, I think, has significantly changed as we've begun to understand our dependence upon it, and even the concept of sustainable development and the need to keep our environment for future generations. These are really concepts from indigenous peoples themselves. They're profound concepts within their society, within their philosophies. And increasingly, we are beginning to understand that this natural world in which we live is very vulnerable, and we have a responsibility towards it. We can't just do with it as we want. And the whole debate about climate change, which is a very big issue, which I probably need another hour to discuss with another expert, but climate change is going to have a profound effect upon us. And we do see our actions actually impacting the world around us. And we will have to think differently about that natural world. And indigenous peoples are going to be helping us to do that. So while there is a sort of an assimilation, you're quite right in terms of, well, indigenous peoples are going to have mobiles and laptops and all this kind of stuff. At the same time, hopefully they will also convey something of their world to us, their philosophy and their vision, because I think we need it too, and we will start to assimilate that. And I think that there's a reciprocity there, something in exchange. Yes, there are lots of things in our world which indigenous peoples want and benefit from, but there are lots of things in their world that we need and that we can benefit from. And I think that's the importance of the dialogue. Mm.
We have 3-4 minutes left. I have a caller here, someone here in Champaign County, so we'll bring them into the conversation. Line number one. Hello. Is the caller there? Line one? There we go. Yeah, we got you. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
I have two questions. I'll ask them and then hang up and listen. In central Illinois here a few years ago, we had an issue that came up in regard to the traditional ownership of land versus modern ownership of land when a group of Native Americans anticipated a suit to recover lands. Does the rights of indigenous peoples treaty help in regard to those kinds of things? And the second question then is in regard to what might be traditional hunting practices in the hunting-gathering mode. We now face loss of salmon in the Northwest, for example, and if Native Americans are allowed to their native practices, might countervene the efforts to save salmon, or perhaps whales, as off the coast of Alaska. Does the treaty help us in those regards? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, two very interesting questions, probably, and very not particularly easy to answer. First of all, on the land issue. Of course, there was a lot of discussion at the United Nations on land issues, and also it was important for indigenous peoples that there should be some provision regarding the restitution of lands, because many indigenous peoples have lost lands. The understanding, of course, is that if the state can restitute land, it can do so only on land that is public land and not the land of others. Having said that, in many countries where states have wanted to restitute or return land to their traditional owners, they have also raised the funds to buy that land. I mean, I can think of examples in many countries in Latin America where the government has bought a land and then returned it to the traditional owners. So there are ways of going forward. The declaration is not a treaty per se. As I said, it's not binding governments. It helps governments. And when talking about restitution, it tries to say, well, there will be issues. There will be indigenous peoples who feel strongly they want to return to their traditional lands. And it may be that those lands are now in the hands of others. But there are solutions. It may be through providing alternative lands that are available publicly, or it may be by buying land on the market and then returning it to indigenous peoples as inalienable collective lands, in the sense of not in terms of private ownership and so on, but in some form that is inalienable to the community. But certainly these issues are not solved by the declaration. What we've done with the declaration is open spaces and hopefully provided some framework for looking for a flexible kind of solutions. And then on traditional hunting practices, this is a very difficult one. Of course, indigenous peoples would say that they have their own conservation policies and they have maintained them. In fact, most of what we benefit today is because indigenous peoples precisely have been conserving nature so carefully. But you're quite right, sometimes indigenous peoples have what they consider to be their traditional hunting or gathering rights or fishing rights, and sometimes these may go up against some environmental legislation and so on. My answer to that is two things. First of all, let's make sure we get the facts right, because sometimes we misinterpret. I say that quite deliberately, because there's a ban on whaling, as many of you know, but it's very important for the Greenlandic people who have traditionally hunted whale, and they don't hunt large numbers, but they have a small quota. And they have always argued that, in fact, the whales that they're hunting are actually not a breed that is disappearing. And so I think they've always said that we are not in the business either of destroying a species. So I think we should get the information correct sometimes. I don't know in the case of the salmon, but certainly I think in general, indigenous peoples have been good conservationists. And I think governments should sit down with them and say, well, we have a problem here. How can we solve it together?
We are at the point that we're going to have to finish up. And we want to thank our guest, Dr. Julian Berger. He is coordinator of the Indigenous and Minorities Unit at the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights based in Geneva. And if you're interested in finding out more about the office and reading some about these issues and you have internet access, go to their website. It is www.ohchr.org, or maybe you just put in UN High Commissioner for Human Rights into your browser, and I'm sure that you can find it. Our guest here on the campus to give a talk, this was the 17th annual Dan Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture last night on the campus. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much.